This is For the Record program number 1132. BioPsyOp Apocalypse Part 8. Remdesivir Uber Alles. This is being recorded on June 1st of the year 2020. We are going to be continuing with our discussion of the BioPsyOp Apocalypse. As I have said in the past, many of the different conceptual divisions between the program are for cognitive purposes only. They are all parts of the same whole, but I am analyzing them and sort of tweezing them apart like I was dissecting a laboratory specimen for the purposes of clarity and understanding. And as was the case with our last program, Moderna Uber Alles, we are taking a look at the development of, last week, a potential vaccine, and this week, a, quote, cure or a help, unquote, for treating the virus that are not only being developed by interests that are well connected, but these are developments that are not only driving the markets as a whole, but are also elevating the stocks of the companies involved as well. And we are going to see how some inside players are helping to game the landscape. First, however, I want to update some developments vis-a-vis the discussion of the virus having been genetically engineered. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we took a look at some articles from GM Watch. That is a British-based publication that is very critical of genetically modified organisms. And they pointed out that there are many, there are a number of techniques of genetically modifying a virus that wouldn't show up in a laboratory technique and to superficial examination, I probably should say, and that were not discussed by a paper from Nature Medicine magazine by a fellow named Christian Anderson and others that has sort of become the go-to slash Warren report of the virus wasn't genetically engineered. In this paper, we are going to, in this program, I should say, we're going to access a couple of other articles from GM Watch that also point out that the virus could very easily have been genetically modified and that, in fact, genetic modifications of this kind were going on in the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China that has become the focal point of the Chinese lab did it hypothesis. And although the experts quoted here are critical of the type of research and do note that these were joint U.S. and Chinese experiments, they also note very importantly that as of 2017, the fact that some of this work was being conducted in a BSL-2, a biosafety laboratory level number 2, which is less than required for some of this work, thereby communicating to the outside world that China was potentially open to a covert operation in which a virus of this kind could be disseminated, blamed on the Chinese either as a deliberate release or an accidental release from the lab. But what the researchers here do not discuss at all is the fact that the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, has documented connections to organizations that have not only served as common U.S. intelligence cutouts in the past, but that have connections to the CIA and the Pentagon. One of the organizations funding this joint U.S.-Chinese research was the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. That is a documented U.S. intelligence cut out. Also, the National Institutes of Health, which are very broad, but which do have a history of collaboration with various U.S. intelligence and military organizations, including the CIA and the military, as we will see. Also, note that the WIV has a decades-old relationship with the U.S. Army's medical, U.S. Army Research, U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRIIB, and that institution at Fort Detrick was closed down for safety violations in early August of 2019. Another important point in the articles we are going to examine is the fact that BSL-4 Laboratories in China just opened its first about a year ago. That was at the WIV. Have dual use, that is, they are not only available as scientific and medical research facilities, but that they also are regularly usable for the development of biological warfare. We have accessed in recent programs a 1999 paper from the BBC in which the British Medical Association warned of the dual use potential of much of the developing biotechnology, and warned that research that would appear to be medical or scientific in nature could actually be used to mask biological warfare research. Note that China has opened one BSL-4 laboratory to date, with another 5 to 7 scheduled to open by mid-century. This compares with a dozen in the U.S. and roughly the same number in Europe, and there are 2 in Taiwan, and there was Taiwan itself, the home to the old Kuomintang, Chinese nationalist narco-fascist regime that fled from the mainland after the communist forces of Mao Zedong took over, and after the victory in the Chinese Civil War immediately after World War II, Taiwan has 2 BSL-4 laboratories. As experts here note, the proliferation of BSL-4 laboratories is scary in and of itself, and they speculate that the Chinese goal of having 5 to 7 may very well be driven by the that it's 5 to 7 by mid-decade is driven by the fact that the U.S. has roughly a dozen such laboratories, and Europe has roughly a dozen such laboratories as well. Now, from GM Watch of May 20th of 2020 by Jonathan Matthews and Claire Robinson, Wuhan and U.S. scientists used undetectable methods of genetic engineering on bat coronaviruses. Evidence has emerged that researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or WIV, in China, working in collaboration with scientists in the USA, have been genetically engineering bat viruses for the past several years to investigate infectivity using undetectable methods. The evidence rebuts claims by journalists and some scientists that the SARS-CoV-2 virus responsible for the current COVID-19 pandemic could not have been genetically engineered because it lacks the, quote, signs, unquote, or, quote, signatures, unquote, that supposedly would be left behind by genetic engineering techniques. Skipping down. Dr. Richard Ebright, E-B-R-I-G-H-T, an infectious disease expert at Rutgers University in the USA, has alerted the public to evidence that WIV and US-based researchers together were genetically engineering bat viruses to investigate their ability to infect humans using commonly used methods that leave no sign or signature of human manipulation. Ebright flagged up a scientific paper published in 2017 by WIV scientists, including Xi Zhengli, the virologist leading the research into bat coronaviruses, working in collaboration with Peter Daszak, D-A-S-Z-A-K, of the D-A-S-Z-A-K of the U.S.-based EcoHealth Alliance. Funding was shared between Chinese and U.S. institutions, the latter including the U.S. National Institutes of Health and USAID. Both, by the way, parenthetically, with links to U.S. intelligence and military. We'll talk more about that later. The researchers report having conducted virus infectivity experiments where genetic material is combined from different varieties of SARS-related coronaviruses to form novel, chimeric, unquote, versions. This form perfectly researched into what mutations were needed to allow certain bat coronaviruses to bind to the human ACE2 receptor, a key step in the human infectivity of SARS-CoV-2. The WIV scientists did this, Ebright points out, using seamless ligation, unquote, procedures that leave no signatures of human manipulation, unquote. This is noteworthy because it is a type of genetic engineering that Anderson and his team excluded from their investigation into whether SARS-CoV-2 could have been engineered, and it was in use at the very lab that is the prime suspect for a lab escape. A group of scientists from the University of North Carolina in the USA, that includes Ralph Barich, about whom we've spoken in the past, with the WIV's Xi Zhengli as a collaborator, published a study in 2015 describing similar experiments involving chimeric coronaviruses, which were also created using standard undetectable genetic engineering techniques. Ebert points out that the paper states, all the work with infectious virus was performed under biosafety level 2 conditions. This level is suitable for work involving agents of not only, quote, moderate potential hazard to personnel and the environment, unquote, but they are not at fault in failing to use BSL-4 for this work, as SARS coronaviruses are not aerosol transmitted. The work does, however, fall under biosafety level 3, which is for work involving microbes that can cause serious and potentially lethal disease via inhalation. The bioscientist Dr. Jonathan Latham criticized this kind of research on bat coronaviruses that has been taking place in Wuhan and the USA as, quote, providing an evolutionary opportunity for such viruses to, quote, jump into humans, unquote. Latham, who has a doctorate in virology, argues that this kind of work is simply, quote, providing opportunities for contamination events and leakages from labs, which happen on a routine basis. And again, note that as soon as this research was published, and given the fact that the National Institutes of Health, which have in the past collaborated with CIA and Pentagon on BSL-4 laboratories, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is well known for fronting for U.S. intelligence operations, including and especially CIA, were helping to finance this work and were undoubtedly aware of what was going on at every stage. From Nature Magazine of Volume 542, February 23rd of 2017, an article by David Cyranoski, C-Y-R-A-N-O-S-K-I, Inside China's Pathogen Lab, Maximum Security Biosafety Facility, nears approval, sparking excitement and concern. Again, this is in 2017, as China was getting ready to open its first biosafety lab, Level 4. A laboratory in Wuhan is on the cusp of being cleared to work with the world's most dangerous pathogens. The move is part of a plan between The move is part of a plan to build between 5 and 7 biosafety or BSL-4 labs across the Chinese mainland by 2025 and has generated much excitement as well as some concerns. Some scientists outside China worry about pathogens escaping and the addition of a biological dimension to geopolitical tensions between China and other nations. Note about this, again, in a 2017 paper, and it was public at this point that some of this work had been done in the BSL-2 lab, whereas a BSL-3 would have been required, thereby providing a strategic opening for a covert operation that would attempt to pin this on China. One of the things not noted in any of the scientific and medical discussion, predictably and not necessarily with a finding of fault, is that all of this has to be taken in the context of not only an overt, full-court economic press against China, but also covert operations with institutions like the National Endowment for Democracy, helping to finance the unrest in Hong Kong and the unrest in the Uyghur section of Xinjiang province. Also elements like Azov Battalion and Pravda sector from Ukraine, working for EU-funded NGOs showing up in Hong Kong. All of this takes place against the background of overt and covert operations against China. And note the following as well. From this Nature magazine article, the expansion of BSL-4 lab networks in the U.S. and Europe over the past 15 years, with more than a dozen now in operation or under construction in each region, also met with resistance, including questions about the need for so many facilities. Speaking of Richard Ebright, again from Rutgers. But Ebright is not convinced of the need for more than one BSL-4 lab in mainland China. He suspects that the expansion is also a reaction to the networks in the U.S. and Europe, which he says are also unwarranted. He adds that governments will assume that such excess capacity is for the potential development of bioweapons. These facilities are inherently dual use, unquote, he says. And we're going to take a look at just exactly what appears to have spurred the increase in BSL-4 labs. And I don't think it is a reach to see the Chinese expansion. They have just opened their first BSL-4 lab with 5 to 7 more planned by mid-decade, a dozen already operating in the U.S. and the same number in Europe. I don't think it is a reach to see this as analogous to the arms race that took place initially between the former Soviet Union and the U.S. and now between China and the U.S., with the U.S. having had an overwhelming lead over the former Soviet Union, despite press to the contrary. We heard about the bomber gap in the 50s and the missile gap in the 60s. The U.S. always had a huge, huge lead. That certainly would appear to be the case in the context of the dual-use BSL-4 laboratories. Now, from 2007, the following article from Newsweek magazine from the issue of December 5th of 2007 is by Jenewand, J-E-N-W-N, Intralandi, I-N-T-E-R-L-A-N-D-I, and it is talking about, quote, high-stakes science, and it talks about the BSL-4 labs, including one that just opened at Boston University. Before the anthrax mailings of 2001, the U.S. had just 2 BSL-4 laboratories, both within the razor wire confines of government-owned campuses. Now, thanks to a tenfold increase in funding from $200 million in 2001 to $2 billion in 2006, more than a dozen such facilities can be found at universities and private companies across the country. Note that the anthrax attacks were ultimately pinned on a Fort Detrick employee named Bruce Ivins, who committed suicide. The investigation was presided over by Robert Mueller of the FBI, whom, as we have seen in the past, has been less than diligent in the many investigations he has overseen. I would note that the initial suspect eventually cleared was Stephen Hatfill, and he was fired from the U.S. AMRIID. I suspect he may very well be CIA. In For the Record 1128, we took a look at a working hypothesis that the apartheid milieu stemming from not only people like Stephen Hatfill, but also the now deceased Dr. Larry Ford, and with links to agency, the CIA, the Project Coast biological warfare program in apartheid South Africa, and the post apartheid of networks like the Organisatie, or the Spider Network, as it was called, a lethal post-apartheid milieu that has links to the Project Coast milieu. We speculated about the possibility of their involvement in a vectoring of New York City with the COVID-19 virus. Whatever the case, maybe with that working hypothesis. Note that it was the anthrax attacks of 2001 that helped to spur a tenfold increase in BSL-4 labs with dual use, $200 million in 2001, $2 billion in 2006 under George W. Bush. Now, about the BSL-4 laboratory at Boston University, note not only that critics have charged that this may very well be a cover for biological warfare research, but that the National Institute of Health contract for the lab included a provision that both the CIA and the Pentagon would be allowed to use the lab for their own research. The NIH helped to finance the work in China. Turning again to this Newsweek article, but some scientists say that argument obscures the true purpose of the current biodefense boom, to study potential biological weapons. The university portrays it as an emerging infectious disease lab, says David Osnoff, a Boston University epidemiologist whose office is right across the street from the new BSL-4 facility. But they are talking about studying things like smallpox and inhalation anthrax, which pose no public health threat other than as bioweapons. The original NIH mandate for the lab indicated that many groups, including the CIA and Department of Defense, would be allowed to use the lab for their own research, the nature of which BU might have little control over. One more time. The original National Institute of Health mandate for the lab indicated that many groups, including the CIA and Department of Defense, would be allowed to use the lab for their own research, the nature of which BU might have little control over. And note again that the University of Wuhan's Institute of Medical Virology has partnered with the U.S. AMRIID, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, since the mid-1980s, from their website. Since the midst of 1980s, cooperated with the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, and as we have looked at in many programs, in early August of 2019, they were shut down, at least temporarily, for safety violations. We quote from a Frederick News article from early August of 2019. Now, turning to the subject of the drug remdesivir. This is manufactured by Gilead Sciences, and we have spoken about remdesivir in the past. First of all, Gilead Sciences is an interesting company. A fellow named C. Benno Schmidt was one of the key early directors of the company. He was a driving force behind Richard Nixon's war on cancer that, among other things, appears to have served as a cover for the development of various biological warfare programs, including and especially the development of AIDS. We took a look at that in many programs, including, for the record, 686. Again, many other broadcasts as well. AFA number 16, FTR program number 606, and others as well. Note that the chairman of the board for many years of Gilead Sciences, the maker of remdesivir, was Donald Rumsfeld, who left his position at chairman of the board to become George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. Note also that many hedge funds, including and especially Renaissance Technologies, have major holdings in Gilead Sciences, and their holdings in Gilead Sciences have increased dramatically in value since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. Renaissance Technologies is the hedge fund of Robert Mercer, Steve Bannon's financial angel. Steve Bannon is at the epicenter of the anti-China effort. And note also that, as was the case with Moderna that we looked at last week, positive reportage about the development of remdesivir has driven the market as a whole. So insider trading, or just a little blowing in the ear, can increase the research, the wealth, I should say, dramatically, as some of the attenuated reportage and attenuated experimentation is reported. From the AP, I've reported many newspapers, including the New York Times of April 30th of 2020. Now note that the information released here was on, or the events described here were on April 29th. Later on in the broadcast, we are going to conclude with something else that happened on April 29th. A guy named Joe Grogan, G-R-O-G-A-N, a key Trump official, departed from the Trump administration. He had much to do with guiding the health policies and the COVID-19 policies of the Trump administration. Prior to joining the Trump administration, he was a lobbyist for Gilead Sciences, the maker of Remdesivir. More about that later. From the AP, April 30th, 2020, possible COVID-19 drug powers markets. Stocks around the world whipped higher, riding a wave of optimism about a possible COVID-19 treatment. The hope was so strong that investors sidestepped a report showing the outbreak drove the U.S. economy to its worst quarterly performance since the Great Recession. The S&P 500 vaulted 2.7% higher on news of Remdesivir and extended a rally that has brought the U.S. stock market to the brink of its best month in 45 years. The spark for Wednesday's rally, again that was Wednesday, April 29th, was a report that an experimental drug proved effective against the new coronavirus in a study run by the National Institutes of Health. NIH has served as a front for CIA and military, and they were also a financier of the experiments done at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Continuing. The nation's top infectious diseases expert said the drug reduced the time it takes patients to recover, and it raised hopes that life around the world may eventually tiptoe back toward normal. And we're going to hear a little more about this initial study. This is a National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases study. From Stat News of April 29th of 2020 by Matthew Herper, H-E-R-P-E-R, and Adam Feuerstein, F-E-U-E-R-S-T-E-I-N. Critical study of Gilead's COVID-19 drug shows patients are responding to treatment, NIH says. During an appearance alongside President Trump in the Oval Office, Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, part of the National Institutes of Health, said that data are a, quote, very important proof of concept, unquote, and that there was reason for optimism. He cautioned that the data were not a knockout. At the same time, the study achieved its primary goal, which was to improve the time to recovery, which was reduced by 4 days for patients on Remdesivir. The preliminary data showed that the time to recovery was 11 days on Remdesivir compared to 15 days for placebo, a 31% decrease. The mortality rate for the Remdesivir group was 8% compared to 11.6% for the placebo group. That mortality difference was not statistically significant. So the test shows that there was a modest benefit from Remdesivir. Patients basically were out of the hospital 4 days sooner when given Remdesivir. It is, however, a very modest improvement. And as we are going to see, there was a serious curtailment of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases experiment, and we're going to see just exactly what that was. This, again, from Stat News, from from May 11th of 2020. This article is by Matthew Herper, H-E-R-P-E-R. Inside the National Institute of Health's controversial decision to stop its big Remdesivir study. Not only was the study attenuated, but the nature of the study was badly attenuated as well. And when we see, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19. That is a group that does have some scientists in it, but it also has some billionaires, including and especially Peter Thiel, who has been steering COVID-19 policy for the Trump administration. And also another of those scientists to stop COVID-19 is Michael Milken, the junk bond king of the 1980s, who was pardoned by Donald Trump. Now, of the Stat News article from May 11th of 2020 about the attenuation of the NIAID study, the NIAID study has described the stat in new detail. The NIAID has described the stat in new detail, how it made its fateful decision to start giving remdesivir to patients who had been assigned to receive a placebo in the study, essentially limiting researchers' ability to collect more data about whether the drug saves lives, something the study called ACTT1 suggests but does not prove. In the trial, 8% of the participants given remdesivir died, compared with 11.6% of the placebo group, a difference that was not statistically significant. A top NIAID official said he had no regrets about the decision. Quote, "There certainly was unanimity within the Institute. This was the right thing to do," said H. Clifford Lane, NIAID's clinical director. And I would note, on the other hand, quote, Stephen Nissen, N-I-S-S-E-N, a veteran trialist and cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic, disagreed that giving placebo patients remdesivir was the right call. Quote, "I believe it is in society's best interest to determine whether remdesivir can reduce mortality, and with the release of this information during a placebo-controlled trial to determine if there is a mortality benefit will be very difficult." He said the question is, was there a route or is there a route to determine if the drug can prevent death? The decision is a lost opportunity, unquote, he said. And still more, Peter Bach, the director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, agreed with Nissen, quote, "The core understanding of clinical research participation and clinical research conduct is we run the trial rigorously to provide the most accurate information about the right treatment," he said. And that answer, he argued, should ideally have determined whether remdesivir saves lives. "The reason we have shut our whole society down," Bach said, "is not to prevent COVID-19 patients from spending a few more days in the hospital. It is to prevent patients from dying. Mortality is the right endpoint," he said. But the change in the study's main goal also changed the way the study would be analyzed. Now the NIAID decided the analysis would be calculated when 400 patients of the 1,063 patients the study enrolled had recovered. And there was less than half of the patients were reported, basically results for less than half of the patients in the study. If remdesivir turned out to be much more effective than expected, quote, interim, unquote, analyses would be conducted at a third and two-thirds that number. The job of reviewing these analyses would fall to a committee of outside experts on what is known as an Independent Data and Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB. But the DSMB for the remdesivir study did not ever meet for an interim efficacy analysis, Lane said. One more time. But the DSMB for the remdesivir study did not ever meet for an interim efficacy analysis, Lane said. All patients had been enrolled by April 20th. The data for a DSMB meeting was cut off on April 22nd. The DSMB met them on April 27th. It made a recommendation to the NIAID. That decision, Lane said, led the NIAID to conclude that patients who had been given placebo should be offered remdesivir, something that started happening after April 28th. And the result was assessed by Dr. Ethan Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, quote, "We have squandered an incredible opportunity to do good science," Dr. Ethan Weiss said. If we ever could go back and do something all over, it would be the infrastructure to actually learn something, because we are not learning enough. And Dr. Weisbach, a cardiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. Now, yet another Stat News article from April 27th by Matthew Herper and Adam Feuerstein. The world wants answers on Gilead's COVID-19 drug. Experts worry next studies may increase uncertainty. Now, this is about a study done by Gilead Sciences. And they did not use a placebo. They said that it was too difficult to manufacture enough placebo in time. I can't make an overall objective evaluation of that. It does seem dubious. And when we get to scientists to stop COVID-19, unquote, you may see why. Well, again, from Stat News of April 27th of this year. But outside experts in clinical trial design worry that the results, instead of leading to a clear picture of whether the medicine is effective, will instead muddy the waters further. The main concern, they say, stems from the fact that the Gilead trial expected to read out this week, which was conducted among patients with severe disease, lacks a control group, that is, patients who are randomly assigned to receive the best treatment available, but not remdesivir. As designed, the only randomization is the duration of treatment, either 5 days or 10 days of drug. Without a true control group of patients, many experts say, it will be difficult to determine whether remdesivir is effective. Again, another evaluation from Stephen Nissen. Quote, the overall study itself has little or no scientific value at all since all patients are receiving the drug, unquote, said Stephen Nissen, the chief academic officer at the Cleveland Clinic and lead investigator of many trials for heart drugs that have been approved by the FDA. Quote, the study as designed is essentially useless and cannot be used by the FDA for consideration of remdesivir for approval to treat coronavirus, Nissen said. And the response by Gilead? In the early stages of the pandemic, we not only had a limited supply of remdesivir, but also a limited supply of the matched placebo required for placebo-controlled studies, said Amy Flood, a Gilead spokesperson. We chose to prioritize manufacturing active drug over placebo, and we provided our supply of placebo to China. Note that because it was a Chinese study we'll talk about in a minute, and NIAID for their studies of remdesivir. Still more. Critics point to Gilead's decision to compare two groups given remdesivir for either 5 days or 10 days. The problem with this strategy, they say, is that an ineffective drug that did nothing and a very effective drug that consistently helped patients overcome the virus would look exactly the same in such a study. Only if the 10-day course were more effective or if it was worse because of side effects would the study have any clear result. Yet another trial in less sick patients, also run by Gilead, does have a control group and may give a clearer answer. Nissen sees a reasonable study design, unquote. But Bach was more critical, saying that even though that study has a control group, the lack of a placebo means the study might not be trustworthy. That is because its main goal, time to improvement of symptoms, could be affected by the perceptions of clinicians and the patients themselves. Bach said the hospitals conducting the study, quote, are easily capable of wrapping syringes in brown paper and blinding the whole thing. I do not understand why you would run a trial like this. Well, again, when we get to the scientists, to stop COVID-19, including Peter Thiel and Michael Milken, I think we may get an idea why that has been done. From Stat News of April 23rd of 2020, this is by Ed Silverman and Adam Feuerstein and the aforementioned Matthew Herper, H-E-R-P-E-R. Now, this is about a remdesivir study in China. Note that the study was cut short because the pandemic itself was receding in China, but these results, which did have the medical gold standard of a randomized controlled trial, these were less than encouraging. The article, new data on Gilead's remdesivir released by accident shows no benefit for coronavirus patients. Company, aka Gilead Sciences, still sees reason for hope. This was put, by the way, accidentally on the website of the World Health Organization. Encouraging data from patients in a study at the University of Chicago were described by researchers at a virtual town hall and obtained by Stat last week. However, unlike those optimistic data, these new results are from a randomized, controlled trial, the medical gold standard. According to the summary of the China study, remdesivir was, quote, not associated with a difference in time to clinical improvement, unquote, compared to a standard of care control. After 1 month, it appeared that 13.9% of the remdesivir patients had died, compared to 12.8% of patients in the control arm. The difference was not statistically significant. In this study of hospitalized adult patients with severe COVID-19 that was terminated prematurely, remdesivir was not associated with clinical or virological benefits, the summary states. The study was terminated prematurely because it was difficult to enroll patients in China, where the number of COVID-19 cases was decreasing. An outside researcher said that the results mean that any benefit from remdesivir is likely to be small. Quote, if there is no benefit to remdesivir in a study this size, this suggests that the overall benefit of remdesivir in this population with advanced infection is likely to be small in the larger Gilead trial, unquote, said Andrew Hill, senior visiting research fellow at Liverpool University. Now, note again, this trial was cut short because the pandemic was receding in China. Nonetheless, the results were less than encouraging. And note the serious problems, the attenuation of both the NIAID studies and the major conditions vis-a-vis Gilead's own trials. And by the way, in the written description for this show, which will be available within a couple of days, the entire articles, or very close to them, will be available for perusal. Now, there was an article in the Motley Fool blog of April 22nd of 2020, this by Max, M-A-X-X, Chatsko, C-H-A-T-S-K-O, called Gilead Sciences Races to Manufacture Remdesivir, the chemistry has speed limits. Now, this notes that Gilead Sciences will face a number of, I guess one could say, institutionalized problems manufacturing a sufficient number, sufficient amount of the drug to treat a large number of patients. This could also lead to enormous profits from Gilead. Some of these problems, again from Motley Fool of April 22nd. Complex chemistry. Antivirals, commonly identified by the suffix, quote, VIR, unquote, are generally very difficult to manufacture at scale. Production processes are hindered by many complex organic chemistry steps that must be completed sequentially, are accompanied by low yields, and require ultra-rare chemical inputs with very limited global supply. The latter might be the most important limiting factor for remdesivir production. Another, quote, strict sterility requirements. Drugs that are administered intravenously, IV, such as remdesivir, must be manufactured in specialty drug compounding facilities under strict sterility conditions. The world has limited production capacity. Volume. Manufacturing antiviral drugs under normal conditions is difficult enough, but the time crunch of a global pandemic adds a new twist. Gilead Science will face pressure to manufacture enough remdesivir to treat tens of millions of individuals, which might be an impossible task. On paper, enzymes could be used to significantly increase the yield of remdesivir while reducing overall inputs and, importantly, reducing the importance of ultra-rare chemical inputs with limited global supply. In reality, it would be very challenging for Gilead Sciences to engineer enzymes specific to remdesivir synthesis, incorporate them into new production processes, and scale those production processes in the compressed timelines it faces. Again, this is much of this discussion in this article is highly technical. The articles from which these excerpts are culled will be available in the written description for the program, and listeners are strongly encouraged to get those and print those up. Now, as to why so many corners have been cut in assessing remdesivir, and I would note that in the very first program I did about the coronavirus outbreak, this was, for the record, 11-11, done back in February, I noted that Thai doctors had used a drug cocktail of oseltamivir, or Tamiflu as it is called, with a couple of common HIV antivirals that had a dramatic effect. A 71-year-old Chinese woman who was gravely sick was able to sit up in bed 2 years later and thank her doctors for treatment and tested negative for the virus. That appears to have gone down the memory hole. We've heard almost nothing about it. Some critics said that the ability to get that much of the HIV drugs could harm HIV patients. It seems to me that using the Defense Production or Defense Authorization Act, I've forgotten the exact title, that President Trump has access to could very easily have resulted in a wartime production of those HIV drugs, and that perhaps would have been an area in which General Perna, who is working on the Warp Speed Vaccine Program, he is head of the Army's Materiel Command, could have been of significant value and assistance in helping to expedite. But we've heard nothing at all about that drug cocktail used by Thai doctors. I suspect, and again, the Moderna Uber Alles show that we did last week and the remdesivir Uber Alles show that we're doing right now are part of the wealth concentration virus phenomenon. We'll talk more about that in weeks to come. But now, the reason why we have been seeing the emphasis on remdesivir, and I suspect also why corners have been cut as they apparently have been, is because of this group. The New York Post of April 28th of 2020, an article by Mark Moore, M-O-O-R-E, scientists and billionaires team up to aid White House in coronavirus battle. Calling themselves Scientists to Stop COVID-19, the collection of top researchers, billionaires, and industry captains will act as an ad hoc review board, unquote, for the torrent of coronavirus research, quote, weeding out, unquote, flawed data before it reaches policymakers, the Wall Street Journal reported on Monday. They are also acting as a go-between for pharmaceutical companies seeking to build a communication channel with Trump administration officials. The group has advised Nick Ayers, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, as well as other agency heads in the past month. Pence is heading up the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The brainy bunch is led by Thomas Cahill, that's a Brainy Bunch, by the way, not Brainy Bunch. The Brainy Bunch is led by Thomas Cahill, capital C-A-H-I-L-L, a 53-year-old doctor who became a venture capitalist. Cahill's clout comes from building connections through his investment firm New Path Partners with Silicon Valley's Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, and billionaire businessmen Jim Pelota and Michael Milken. Let's start with Michael Milken, the convicted junk bond king of the 1980s. He was recently pardoned by Donald Trump. He was a convicted felon. Peter Thiel, as I've always spoken about many times, a key investor in Facebook, a member of Facebook's board of directors, the driving force behind Palantir, the alpha predator of the electronic surveillance landscape, a man who explicitly rejects democracy as being inimical to wealth creation, doesn't think women should be allowed to vote, and takes much of his political and legal reference point, or stance, I should say, from Carl Schmitt, who was the Third Reich's top legal theoretician. And again, he is one of the driving forces behind, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19, along with Michael Milken. Now, Thomas Cahill and New Path Partners. This from Fortune magazine of April 28th of 2020. The venture capitalist at the center of the coronavirus fight. This by Lucinda Shen, S-H-E-N. At the helm of the effort, the 33-year-old and very much under-the-radar venture capitalist Tom Cahill, who leads life sciences-focused New Path Partners. That's, by the way, N-E-W-P-A-T-H. Cahill completed his MD and PhD at Duke University a mere 2 years ago before landing at blue-chip investment firm Raptor Group through a friend. He went on to found New Path Partners with some $125 million after impressing well-connected names like venture capitalist Peter Thiel and Vista Equity Partners co-founder Brian Sheth, S-H-E-T-H. It was through Sheth, for example, that scientists to stop COVID-19 connected with the co-chairman of the Republican National Committee, Thomas Hicks Jr. Now, we have spoken about Hicks at great length at for the record 11-11, 11-12, and 11-13. In addition to being co-chairman of the RNC and an intimate of the Trump White House, very close to Donald Trump Jr., he also is heavily involved in the interagency governmental networks involved with the anti-China effort, including apparently CIA. He also has in the past been a co-investor with J. Kyle Bass, who was asymmetrically invested to the Chinese and Hong Kong economies. In other words, he was asymmetrically invested to those economies, meaning if those economies go down, which in Hong Kong's case it did and continues to do, and in China's case it did, it's still way down, but it is coming back, then he profits. And note that he also in the past has been a co-investor with Tommy Hicks Jr. when asked, as we looked at in For the Record 11-11 and 11-12, and 11-13, whether he was still involved with J. Kyle Bass. He didn't deny it, but basically shunted off the question. Point being that Tommy Hicks Jr. is involved in the anti-China effort in a big way, an apparent co-investor with J. Kyle Bass, who also helped to bring down Bear Stearns in the 2008 collapse. And he also, as co-chairman of the Republican National Committee, is obviously networking with some of the one percenters who are at the core of the Republican Party. More about what this group is doing. This from The Hill of April 28th of 2020 by Alexandra Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y. Elite group of scientists and billionaires are working together to fight the coronavirus pandemic. This is, quote, scientists to stop COVID-19, including scientists like Peter Thiel and Michael Milken. Scientists to Stop COVID-19 recommends in this phase, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, should work to coordinate with Gilead Pharmaceuticals to focus on expediting the results of clinical trials for remdesivir, a drug identified as a potential treatment for COVID-19. The group also recommends administering doses of the drug to patients in an early stage of infection and notes remdesivir will essentially be a placeholder until a more effective treatment is produced. Government entities and agencies appear to adhere to the recommendations outlined by the group, with the journal reporting that the FDA and Department of Veterans Affairs, or VA, have implemented some of the group's suggestions, namely relaxing drug manufacturer regulations and requirements for potential coronavirus treatment drugs. And we began the discussion of remdesivir after talking about the WIV BSL-4 labs and genetic engineering with an article from the AP from April 30th talking about a huge uptick in the markets on April 29th because of the release of the positive information from what we now know was a very attenuated NIAID study. We also know that Scientists to Stop COVID-19 have recommended, as we saw here, that they've implemented regulations, namely relaxing drug manufacturer regulations and requirements for potential coronavirus treatment drugs, which I think may very well explain some of the attenuation of the NIAID studies and Gilead study that we saw. Now, we're going to conclude with something else that happened on April 29th. This from The Hill from April 29th of 2020. Top Trump policy advisor Joe Grogan to leave Post. Grogan, this article, by the way, is by Morgan Chalfant, C-H-A-L-F-A-N-T. Grogan has served as the director of the White House Domestic Policy Council since February of 2019, overseeing a broad array of policy issues, including health care and regulation. Grogan was one of the original members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force launched in late January. Grogan worked as a lobbyist for drug company Gilead Sciences, the maker of remdesivir, before joining the Trump administration. And he left on April 29th. That was the day that the NIAID study was released, driving up the markets. Note again that the hedge funds, including Renaissance Technologies, heavily involved with Gilead Sciences, as we have spoken in the past. So an awful lot of information there. Again, highly technical, but please reference the written description, which will be available for this program within a couple of days. This concludes For the Record program number 1132, BioPsyop Apocalypse Now, Part 8, Remdesivir Uber Alles, being recorded on June 1st of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.